You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It's Friday, December 1st. We're talking some Indians baseball as we bring in MLB.com's Anthony Castrovince. Anthony, thanks very much for taking the time. We'll get into some of the decisions being made about arbitration-eligible players, the Indians with several of those. But first, let's start off a little bit of changes in the organizations or promotions. And a couple of guys, Mike Chernoff, the GM, talked about Bud Grant and Scott Barnsby. When a team has success, those guys sometimes fall through the cracks, the people in the front office there and the jobs they're doing. So they were promoted today. Just talk a little bit about Grant and Barnsby and what they mean to the organization.
Brad Grant's been absolutely huge for this organization. You think about how far their drafts have come in the last, decade or so. They used to be routinely criticized for, some first-round picks or early prominent picks gone awry. But under Grant, you talk about Francisco Lindor, Tyler Naquin, of course, had a great rookie year for them. Clint Frazier, who was a huge trade piece. Brad Zimmer, who had an instant impact here in 2017. Justice Sheffield was a huge trade piece as well. So they've had a much better track record under Brad Grant. So well-deserved for him. He'll branch out into a more widespread role in baseball operations. I'm sure he'll still have a hand on the amateur side and be a tremendous resource for those guys under him. But it's really a chance for him to kind of spread his wings, and deservedly so, because he's made a huge impact on this organization. And Barnsby, frankly, I don't know him as well on a personal level, but I'm just going to go with their guidance and wisdom on this one, because it's been obviously a tremendous front office tree, if you will, and be it guys who have stayed with the Indians or even guys who have branched off to other things. So Scott Barnsby is part of that lineage and gets a great opportunity to kind of influence the draft here moving forward. But again, I think to me the big news here and the big takeaway was just Brad Grant really being rewarded for having such a huge hand in this organization. It's so vital for them to do well in the draft. We know that because, as we see, as I'm sure we'll see this winter, it's not about spending money with this organization. There's a rare instance like Edwin Encarnacion a year ago, but by and large, you got to build from within. You got to have that pipeline, and they've turned out some really quality players here in recent years.
Yeah, that connection between the GM and then the people that work for him is so important, and sometimes they only get noticed if something goes wrong, so it's nice to see them get noticed when they're doing something right and get that recognition promotional as well. Let's go on to some of the arbitration-eligible players we're talking right now on Friday. And tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, decisions have to be made. The Indians with seven arbitration-eligible players they're making decisions on. I had seen Abraham Almonte might be the only non-tender candidate, but what have you heard, Anthony, in terms of the arbitration-eligible guys with Cleveland?
Yeah, and by the time people listen to this, I guess we'll see what has happened. But, to my eyes, I don't think they have any non-tenders. Almonte would probably be the one guy maybe most on the bubble, but, have the option with him. And, we're talking about a minuscule amount of money for a guy who's given them some nice production, when healthy in the past. So I think he's kind of a valuable depth piece for this organization. So I see them tendering all those guys' contracts. I guess you could say, maybe Zach McAllister would be another, maybe a bubble guy in normal circumstances. I'm not sure. But, this team just lost Brian Shaw and Joe Smith. I shouldn't say lost. Those guys are both free agents. We'll see what happens in free agency. But, bullpen depth is obviously very vital in this game. And McAllister, has had some really nice stretches for this club. So, and Dan Otero, of course, as well. Neither of those guys were on the Division Series roster, but I think there's a lot of clubs who would have rostered them in a Division Series environment, just kind of spoke to the depth of the pitching staff in general. I don't see any non-tenders coming out of this, but we'll see what happens later tonight.
Right. But we'll check back with you, and then we'll see if you're totally right on that or not. I assume you will be for sure. You mentioned Edwin Encarnacion earlier, and Indians kind of waited out the free agency process last year, and that was quite a pickup for a really good dollar amount to be able to bring Encarnacion in, put him in the middle of that order, and it immediately paid dividends. What do you see the Indians doing in free agency this year? Same type of process, the way they're looking at it? Obviously, the winter meeting's 2 weeks away, or do you expect them to kind of go slow in this process like they did last year?
Yeah, it will be similar from that standpoint where, kind of waiting for the market to come to you rather than you pursuing it. I mean, a year ago at this time, If we would have been doing this podcast, I would have said they have no chance at Edwin Encarnacion. I think that they might have said something similar, quite as strong, but something very similar. And then, things really started to change really around the time of the winter meetings. And then, shortly thereafter, things really gained momentum. So, but the difference this year is that they signed Encarnacion. He's on their books now. And I don't know. I think when you look at their roster complexion right now with Encarnacion in tow, with some guys getting raises from their contracts, with some arbitration eligible guys, they're basically payroll-wise at where they were going into 2017, which was already a franchise record payroll. So I don't see much addition going on here, not on a seismic level. They obviously have to make some moves. They have holes to fill. But I don't think it's going to be anything quite to that level. I do think you always hold out the possibility that with the way MLB's market has evolved in recent years and the way power has been depreciated in particular, that, maybe something does fall back to them. I went into the season thinking they have no chance of re-signing Carlos Santana. Started to look around at the beginning of the offseason and started to think, well, there is an avenue for that to happen, for him to come back to them. And that avenue would be the sheer depth of the first base market really lowering his price tag. But the sense I've gotten is that he's very highly valued in the industry, as he should be. I mean, the guy's got a .365 career on base percentage. I think that stat right there has tremendous value in today's game. It's something that general managers, executives really put a high value on. So I don't see it happening with Carlos Santana. Jay Bruce, maybe, just because, again, the depreciation of power, especially for players north of 30. But, I think first base is more sensible pick for them right now. I think that's the spot where they really need to be focused on. And obviously Jay Bruce, he probably could play at first base, but that's not his go-to position. So that'll be interesting. But yeah, by and large, I expect them to just look for value plays. And that first base market in particular has the potential to help them out there, because there are so many guys available out there. And then Jose Abreu's on the trade market. So there's just a lot of talent there, and that could lead to them getting some value for that spot.
Yeah, you never know. Things can certainly change in a hurry in those situations. We're talking with MLB.com's Anthony Castrovince, and no podcast, no discussion of baseball these days is complete without at least mentioning Shohei Ohtani. So let me ask you about him, and then we'll finish up talking Omar Vizquel and his Hall of Fame chances. But in terms of Ohtani, it seems like every team has been linked to him in some ways, and he's the Japanese sensation, can pitch, can hit, can do a little bit of everything. And now he's set to come over to the majors as the $20 million posting fee has been agreed upon. But because the actual dollar amount isn't a lot in terms of what a team needs to pay him per year, everyone seems to be involved. So from an Indians point of view, is Ohtani reachable? Is he a guy they could get?
I don't see that. Obviously, they love Ohtani. I think most people love Ohtani. He's just such a unique talent. This is such a unique circumstance where, as you said, every team is in on him at some level. You kind of have to be. You wouldn't be doing your due diligence otherwise. $20 million posting fee is, a pittance, but it's still, for a franchise like the Indians, it's still a large outlay at the start. I think that the problem, of course, is Ohtani's got to be thinking about, listen, this guy's not all about the money. If he was, he'd be waiting another couple years when he could get, a nine-figure contract. But he does have to think about, the long-term fit, and, he's going to come cheap these first couple years. But there's going to be an extension there at some point, you would think, with whatever the original team is. And are the Indians in the best position to do that? Probably not. They're an American League club, which works in their favor. But I just think there's better fits for him at this juncture. But he's obviously a fascinating figure, man. You talk about a guy who has a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, can hit the ball 500 feet. I think that he'll be a pitcher before long. Maybe I'm just being overly skeptical, but I just think it's so hard. There's a reason we haven't had two-way players at the major league level. It's just the amount of work it takes behind the scenes to be a high-quality. I think Corey Kluber is a great example of the guy who puts in the work, those 4 days he's not pitching, to put in that physical work and be a position player or a DH would be a tremendous physical toll in what is already a really physically taxing game over the course of 162 games. So we'll see how that all shakes out. But, the Indians, are in on him like everybody. They scouted him going back to his high school days, but I think they acknowledge internally that they don't have the best chance at making this happen.
Yeah, it seems that way. If they had one potential lure that other teams don't have, it's to me, it's Terry Francona, and that, you know, he's managed big-time profile people going back to Michael Jordan in minor league baseball and dealt with a lot of situations in Boston and everything. So maybe that could
be. And LeBron,
be
how about some marketing opportunities with LeBron, too?
That, exactly.
That's a selling point, right?
That would be interesting to see. Hey, you never know. We should be pitching this for the Indians right now. Let's wrap up here, Anthony, and talk a little Omar Vizquel, his chances for the Hall of Fame. Defensively, as good as there ever was at the position, right up there with Ozzie Smith, really an icon there in the history of Cleveland baseball. Does he have enough, though, to get in? His offensive numbers, obviously not great, but does he have enough to get in this time?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly not on the first ballot. I think he's a guy who voters, you know, and then hopefully Kenny Lofton, you remember a few years back, didn't even get the 5% to stay on the ballot, which I thought was really a shame. I thought his case deserves some greater scrutiny. And I certainly, you know, hope the same for Omar. I hope that he doesn't, you know, get knocked off the ballot, but I think there'll be enough support to keep him on the ballot here moving forward. But I don't know. His Hall of Fame case is so, to me, it's basically you have to use Luis Aparicio as, you know, the reason to get Omar Vizquel in the Hall of Fame, you know, because otherwise offensively he just doesn't stack up. I mean, he had 82 OPS plus in his career. That's 18% below the league average. So, you know, is just defense alone enough to get you in the Hall? And the other thing he's got in his favor is just sheer longevity. You know, he's a compiler, so to speak, 24 seasons. And so that's why he's got, you know, these extreme marks in terms of games played at shortstop and hits as a shortstop. And these are great things, and I love Omar Vizquel. And again, I hope people give it some real thought. But I don't know that he's a Hall of Famer, except for the Aparicio, you know, precedent. And is that precedent enough? You know, I think that voters in more recent years have had increasingly high standards for getting the Hall of Fame, and there's all kinds of metrics now to really weigh these things. So, you know, I don't think he's an Ozzie Smith type. I think Smith had a better offensive career and some bigger individual seasons than did Vizquel. But again, I mean, Omar's best case is just how long he lasts in this game at a demanding physical position. And yeah, he was so gifted defensively, such a joy to watch defensively. For me personally, you know, such a joy to cover and to get to know. But I don't know. I don't know if that's enough to get him in the Hall of Fame, though.
MLB.com's Anthony Castrovince joining us. Anthony, really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, I'm Darwin Zook, and thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Tuesday, November 28th, and we're talking some White Sox baseball. We bring in White Sox reporter for MLB.com, Scott Merkin. Scott, thanks as always for taking the time, and I'll be a little bit of a thief right off the bat here. I was reading your mailbag questions on MLB.com and the fans with a lot of different questions on their minds. So I'm going to take one that I noticed right off the bat. It's 2 weeks till the winter meetings, and obviously the White Sox have plenty of young prospects. But maybe to accelerate the growth of the rebuild, if you will, could there be a big free agent name that could be coming to town? The fans mentioned maybe Manny Machado, or is that something that would not happen as imminent as some fans might think?
Well, I think, first of all, White Sox fans, judging by the questions, have some great knowledge. And I think anyone who was doubtful that the Sox fans would accept the rebuild, which is one of the reasons I think they took a while to finally get to that full rebuild part, now have their answer. The Sox fans are embracing this and then some. They probably study the prospects almost as much as Rick Hahn and Chris Getz and Nick Hostetler and Kenny Williams do. So they're ready to go. I think the big free, first of all, I think the veteran who, you know, is helping the young guys right now is there, and that's Jose Abreu. He's a key component. And I know people kind of, I don't know, maybe look away from the mentor quality in players because of the fact, as I've said before on the podcast, that, you know, with StatCast and Fangraphs and Baseball Reference and everything else, there's so many good stats you can, especially StatCast. I mean, StatCast has opened up so many different avenues for stats to qualify and quantify, you know, major leaguers. But I think there still is something to be said for the chemistry in the clubhouse, the fit, and guys who can, you know, make it easier for younger guys. And one of the things that Abreu has done is, you know, he's not only kind of the face of the team, he's the voice of the team. But you asked more about free agency, and there's going to be, I think, a few guys that are signed this year. I don't think they're going to be, you know, the big long-term names. These may be guys that they can sign and have for part of the season and flip, or maybe guys who they sign with an eye towards extending out if, you know, they perform well and they figure they do fit the window when the team is supposed to contend somewhere maybe in 19, more likely 2020. But, you know, the question that all Sox fans are pointing to, that great free agent class of next offseason, Manny Machado, you know, Bryce Harper to name a few, and then I believe Nolan Arenado is the year after that. And, you know, I'll just go, like I said in that, in the answer to that question, Rick Hahn has said a number of times that when the time to spend is there, the money will be there. You know, so and they know, they watch the Cubs, they watch the Astros, they watch the Royals. You got to finish off the rebuild. It's rare, if ever, that a rebuild exists solely on top young players. So you got to finish it off. They know there's going to be some spots they need to add and upgrade on. Now, does that mean they're going to go out and give a huge contract to one player, or are they going to make some key spending in three or four different guys? And again, I think the champions proved that it's not always the biggest star, but it's kind of the right fit among the stars that kind of brings you the title. So yeah, in answer to your question, I think there is going to be some additions this offseason, but I think if you're pointing to more significant free agent additions, it's probably going into the 19 season and the 2018 offseason for the White Sox.
Yeah, Scott, and it's interesting, too. You bring up a good synergy right now kind of between the fans and the front office, that the fans have adopted this rebuild process and are being patient, which is a good sign. It certainly allows then the front office to not also then be impatient and maybe make moves that would be too quick, rather than giving the young players the time to develop. Do you get the sense with the Astros now winning the World Series and the way they went about things with great draft picks and building up the team that way, that there's more a sense with a team like the White Sox, like, hey, we can follow this model and this might be the way to go about it?
Yeah, I think the Astros, and of course, you know, as much, I think they even admit this, even with the, you know, sort of sibling rivalry there is in Chicago. I mean, the Cubs obviously followed that same plan.
Right.
And the Royals, to some extent, you know, the Royals had that same core that they let develop together, play together, and win and kind of lose together before they won together. And it's a good point you made, Darwin, that the Sox have been great through the first year, at least, of this rebuild about not pushing guys until they're absolutely ready. You know, I mean, there was a couple opportunities last year for Lopez or Giolito to come up there, or, you know, maybe Moncada could have come up a month before he actually did. But, you know, they basically waited. I know Moncada, they basically waited until they felt like he wasn't getting the right challenge anymore at AAA Charlotte. So it was only natural to bring him up there. And now this year, I think, is going to be the big season for all these guys, in that Moncada is going to be the everyday second baseman from the first day of spring training. Giolito is going to be, you know, the two or three guy in the rotation. The same with Lopez. So there's going to be, you know, they've given them the chance to build. They've given them the chance to fail a little bit in the minor leagues, which is key. There's been some guys I've seen come up to the White Sox, maybe rushed a little bit, who were great talents, and they just, you know, I don't want to say they didn't handle failure at the big level, but they couldn't adjust once it started going south. So I think the Sox have done a great job. And like you said, the they've mentioned a couple of times how the fans have been very supportive of what they're doing and understand the process as well as they do.
Yeah, that's certainly important as part of the rebuild. With that said, though, I know fans are anxious to see Michael Kopech, Eloy Jimenez. When do we see those two guys? Now that we talked about patience, when do we actually see those guys now, in terms of there's so much buzz, particularly around Jimenez as well?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, fans loved Jose Quintana when he was part of the White Sox rotation. I think fans, much like the White Sox, still look back and say, you know, man, how could we not win with Chris Sale and Jose Quintana at the top of the rotation? Valid question. The White Sox asked it themselves, and they eventually went to the rebuild to try and correct that issue. But in trading Jose Quintana, they got, you know, a monster prospect back in Eloy Jimenez. He's one of these guys who, you know, possibly along with Moncada, or, you know, who knows who else emerges, could be the guy that you end up building, you know, the Carlos Correa or the Anthony Rizzo or the Chris Bryant that you build the rebuild around. And I mean, Jimenez, since I said this before, since he's been in Chicago, whether it's with the Cubs or with the White Sox, has done nothing but hit. He had a great winter league season, you know, that he just concluded a couple weeks ago. I think he's a little further off than Kopech. Kopech, you know, was lights out last year for Birmingham, finished the season with a couple starts at Charlotte, will start at Charlotte this year. I've heard that, you know, Kopech could be on the same path as Ronaldo Lopez was last year, where, you know, if he gets a month or so, or maybe a little more than that in Charlotte, comes up and becomes part of the rotation. You know, they're not, again, this year, if they were to be competitive or win, I think it would still be a surprise. I think this is still a year where they're looking to develop guys, add a little more talent, and not just a little more talent, add a lot more talent. And if it ends up being another losing season and you get another good draft pick out of it, so be it, because the process is being served. So, you know, there's no rush for these guys. But when they get there, it's going to be just like last year. I know I was at the game, and Rick Hahn's mentioned this a few times. Yeah, I've never seen a crowd in Moncada's first at bat give a standing ovation for like a couple foul balls. And that's what happened. I think he ended up making out in the first at bat, but people just kind of lost their mind the first time he got up there. And I'm sure it's going to be the same thing when Kopech makes his first start for the White Sox or when Jimenez is in his first game for the White Sox in the outfield.
We're talking with Scott Merkin, White Sox reporter for MLB.com. Let's switch gears a little bit. Hall of Fame ballot has come out. Jim Thome is on it. He hit his 500th career home run as a member of the White Sox and had a great impact with the team from all accounts over his three-plus years there in Chicago. Is Thome pretty much a shoo-in in your eyes to get into Cooperstown?
Well, I think it's easier for me to talk about it because I do not have a vote yet this year since I haven't been part of the – I've covered the team for – this is my 16th year, but I've only been part of the BBWA for a few years. So I think he's in. I think he's an absolute first-ballot player. I think he's a first-ballot person, first of all. People always ask me, you know, hey, you know Jim Thome. Is he a nicer guy as he seems? And I'm like, actually, he's even nicer than he seems, if that's possible. And I think that, you know, may play a role for some people who are – I don't really know how you can be on the fence, though, with a guy who's, what, one of nine players in baseball history to hit over 600 home runs, his on-base percentage, his hits, his RBIs, his runs scored, everything he meant to that great Cleveland dynasty that they had. And then, you know, he's still doing it, as you said, with the White Sox, and he's part of the front office now, and he's done a great job, you know, helping young talent. I know they're not voting people in what he's doing now, but – I think he's got to be a first ballot guy. I think this could be actually, you know, you look at the ballot and could be a really great class of four or five, you know, legendary players in there. The one guy who I'm interested in, Darwin, I don't know what you think about him, is he played one season for the Sox, is Andruw Jones. You know, when he was at his peak, he was as good as anyone in the outfield that I've seen. And now I haven't seen everyone in the history of the game, but I realize he'll be penalized maybe a little bit for his late, you know, played struggles and all that, but boy, he was a pretty, he had some Hall of Fame numbers at his peak, I would say.
Oh yeah, no, to me, he's a guy that should be in, but I'm always someone who looks at, if you have a 5-year window where you're one of the top three players in the game,
right,
then that should mean something more than the twilight of your career maybe not going the way you wanted it to go. So to me,
that's
yeah,
a good
Jones,
point. Yeah. And that's again when you talk about Jim Thome, you know, his window was even bigger than that. So I think they're going to be celebrating Jim's induction come January.
Absolutely. And before we wrap up here, Scott, the offseason, so much is talked about trades and money and free agency. Sometimes we forget to focus on the great things organizations and particular players are doing in the community with charity work. One of the things the White Sox are doing that you wrote about is they've teamed up with this Curate comedy event, a unique way of raising money to support cancer patients and their families. The third annual event, I believe, took place. You wrote about it. Tell us a little bit more about what the White Sox have done there.
Yeah, first of all, great comedy that night. But it centers more on family, Pat McGann and Sarah McGann. And some people across the country may know Pat at this point because Pat's been on a Stephen Colbert show. He's open for Sebastian, I think you pronounce his name, Manicoso. And I've heard from people after I wrote that story, and that story was, you know, published, that they've seen him around the country and think he's hilarious. And he's a funny guy and a great guy. And their son, Elliot, unfortunately, has been battling leukemia. He's in a good place now from, you know, a kind of, I don't want to say dire, but a very serious spot when he first was diagnosed in 18 months. And they've developed this fundraiser and Pat's association with the White Sox. He also does a podcast for the team called The Cycle. And he also helps at Sox Fest. And it is just there at the ballpark and does some stuff with them. So they've, you know, kind of worked in conjunction with him. But I think it's more Pat and his wife, Sarah, that have, and the Chicago comedy community have kind of spearheaded this event. And they raised about $25,000, I think, on that Sunday night alone. So
wow.
It was a great event. And as his wife said, it was good to tackle kind of a serious, tough subject with a little humor at times.
Absolutely. Well said, Scott. And we appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Okay, thanks, Darwin. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. That was Scott Merkin, and I'm Darwin Zook. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Friday, December 1st, and we're talking some Tigers baseball. We bring in Tigers reporter for MLB.com, Jason Beck. Jason, thanks as always for taking the time. And so now it's December 1st, you know, the offseason in full swing, the winter meeting's 2 weeks away. So I wanted to ask you right out of the gate here, if we take a step back and look at the Tigers, if we're looking at a rebuilding process, where does that stand? Fans kind of want to know where are things going, what's the direction, and where are they right now in that rebuild mode?
Well, I think right now you have to look at it and say that, you know, they're still in the early stages you still have some veterans on the roster that are left over from the window of contention, guys who at some point or another, either through trades or just through free agency or whatever, are going to end up working their way out. Ian Kinsler being probably at the top of the list, but other guys beyond that. And you haven't yet seen, I think, for the most part at least, you haven't seen the guys who are likely to be a part of that next window in which you're hoping to contend. So, you know, right now, really, you look at it and the teardown's still going on. The developmental stage, I think, is to come. You know, you'll probably start seeing the early stages of that here in the near future. Really, you can kind of look at it in some cases like Candelario at third base. In some way, for some guys, it's already going on. But I think really that developmental stage is going to be picking up once they stock up on some more prospects and once you start seeing some of those prospects they pick up work their way up into the big league club later on next season or in 2019.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too. You talk about fans sometimes get a little impatient, but in order to rebuild and renovate, you have to tear down a little, and you got to get to that point before you can really lay in the foundation to follow through with that analogy. So, as you said, they're still kind of going through that, but they do still have young players that are making their way up. One of those guys, 25-year-old infielder Dixon Machado. You wrote about him earlier this week, I believe, and he was named Tigers Rookie of the Year by the Detroit sports media, but a bit without a position. It seems like his natural fit might be shortstop. Where do you see him fitting in next year and down the road?
Well, I think it depends on what the Tigers do here in the winter meetings and later on this offseason. He's somebody you could slot into second base if and when the Tigers trade Ian Kinsler, but his more natural position is shortstop. That said, it's a tougher scenario to see Jose Iglesias getting traded and opening up that spot. They tried to dangle him out there on the trade market last offseason and again this past summer and really didn't get much interest. Could that change here with teams looking for short-term fixes with short? Yeah, it could, but he's still a guy where it's hard to see a match unless a team that has thumbed their nose at him in the recent past changes their minds and looks at some value there. But he's in kind of that weird area where the Tigers see him as their shortstop of the future, but there's not a shortstop opening quite yet. And because he's out of minor league options, they can't have him developing down in Toledo like he had been. He really was almost like a Rule 5 pick this past season, even though he wasn't official Rule 5 pick. But they had to keep him in the majors because they didn't want to lose him. And they thought that if they put him on waivers to try to designate him for assignment, that some other team would claim him.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, when you're out of options, you got to play him somewhere, and he's got to stay with the big league club. So, yeah, that'll certainly be something to figure out. And I guess you have to wait for other dominoes to fall, like with Ian Kinsler. And let's stay on Kinsler and some of the veterans on the team, Nicholas Castellanos as well. What other potential trade scenarios do you foresee perhaps coming up in the offseason with the winter meetings 2 weeks away? Because the Tigers definitely have some valuable assets in veteran players. So what could you foresee happening there?
Well, it will be interesting to see if anything develops with Shane Green. I know he's only been the closer for a couple months now, but before that, he had a very good half season in his setup role, really seemed to embrace that relief mentality after converting there full-time. And I think part of it's a product of a market where there's just so many teams looking for relief help, and Green carries the appeal that he's had some recent success, and he projects to be a pretty effective reliever, but he also has the appeal of 3 years of team control, which is something that really no other guy that the Tigers could dangle out there carries that appeal, short of Michael Fulmer, who's really more of a wild card now. So they didn't get a whole lot of interest over the summer in green, even though they were willing to listen on him, which was kind of surprising. I bet that changes this winter. I just don't know if they could get enough interest now to where they'd be willing to do a deal now rather than waiting until next trade deadline or next offseason to do something. Time's really on their side, but that window to where teams could get 3 years of green with some cost control might be appealing for a team to do something. And as I mentioned, Michael Fulmer is kind of the wild card in this whole thing. You know, there were certainly teams interested last summer. The Tigers would have had to be overwhelmed. I think they still would. It really would take quite a package. But that said, he's really the one player out there on their roster who could draw the type of prospect package that could jumpstart the rebuilding process, kind of in the same way that Chris Sale was the guy for the White Sox to do the same thing last winter. I'd be surprised if something happens, but I bet we hear some buzz about that during the winter meetings.
Yeah, and I mean, it's tough for fans to sometimes stomach that too, when you lose a player like Fulmer, saying, hey, he could be part of the cornerstone of the rebuild process. But when you can get back prospects, like you said, if he could command that type of package, then it's certainly worth it for the team to really – to really look at. You also mentioned relief pitching, that the Tigers avoided arbitration with reliever Blaine Hardy. He signed a one-year deal. By the time people hear this, tonight is the trade, the non-tender deadline tonight. So people kind of know what the Tigers have decided to do, but six other players eligible for salary arbitration. What do you expect the Tigers to do with those guys by tonight?
Well, I mean, I think Nick Castellanos is going to be sticking around, but it'll be interesting to see if any teams try to express some interest in him. He's got a right-handed power bat who still has a couple years of control. If you're going to deal a guy like that, he's not going to be part of the rebuild because, you know, he's going to hit free agency before you can realistically expect this team to contend again. But he's still young, you know, just 25 years old. I would suspect that they'll listen on him. I just don't know if there's going to, you know, what type of interest is going to be out there. But he might be a surprise deal. Maybe not right now, but maybe later on in the offseason once we see what happens with guys like Giancarlo Stanton and, you know, maybe some Ohtani, maybe some other hitters. He might be kind of that sneaky young power bat that could be on the market that could draw some interest later on once some other teams have sorted out what they're doing. J.D. Martinez, another piece that might have to fall before we kind of see if there's a market out there for him. You know, Bruce Rondon's kind of that guy who's been frustrating Tigers fans for years now. He's been the Tigers closer of the future for like 5 years running. I don't think anybody expects him to be the closer anytime soon, but he's still a power arm and he's still just 26 years old. So he's a guy who's hard to let go of. But the Tigers have to figure out what they have in him. He's gotten second chances and been frustrating for them in so many different ways. He was so frustrating this year, they didn't even give him a September call-up. So it's, you know, really, if they hold on to him, it's kind of one last shot to see if he can, you know, react to being, you know, getting a fresh start with a new coaching staff. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with some of these guys, even those who stick around.
Jason Beck joining us here. And Jason, as we wrap things up, I've just been asking everyone, obviously the hot button topics now, Giancarlo Stanton and, of course, Shohei Ohtani. And Ohtani today, it was decided $20 million posting fee for any team that would want him. And it seems like every team would want to be in on this 23-year-old sensation, two-way prodigy, if you will. Not necessarily that the Tigers would be the appealing case, but just your overall take on Ohtani and the way you see that shaking out.
I can't see the Tigers being involved on that, honestly. I mean, there's certainly some appeal there. You get a guy like that at this stage of his career, that talent level, while getting 6 years of team control, certainly there's an appeal there. But it's, you know, there's so little history with the Tigers and Japanese players. They've always been averse to the posting system. They've never gone all in on a guy like that, and there's no real history there, even though I think it goes overlooked that, you know, Detroit's actually a more diverse city than people give it credit for. There's a lot of different cultures depending on which neighborhoods and which suburbs you go around. And there is a Far Eastern population here. It's not nearly as prominent as it is in cities on the east or west coasts. But because of the various industries here, especially the auto industry influence, you know, there's kind of a quiet, Far Eastern population here. So a signing like that certainly would be an awakening for that segment of Detroit. All the different factors and the Tigers being so far away from contention, it's hard to see that happening.
Yeah, definitely seems unlikely, but you never know. And this whole process certainly fascinating to follow through the offseason right now, as are the Tigers, and to see how they continue their tear down and rebuild in that whole process. Jason, thanks so much for the time. As always, we'll check in with you again soon.
Sounds good. Talk to you later.
Absolutely. Jason Beck joining us here. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Friday, December 1st, and we're talking some Royals baseball. We bring in Royals reporter for MLB.com, Jeffrey Flanagan. Jeffrey, thanks as always for taking the time. And let's start with some news in just this afternoon. Mike Moustakas, named American League Comeback Player of the Year. He returns from that ACL injury suffered in 2016, played just 27 games, and had a tremendous 2017 season. 38 home runs, by far and away his career high. So has to feel good, right, for Moustakas, not only to come back from the injury, but kind of come back better than ever, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is might be the third one comeback player he's won, if you go around the horn here. A well-deserving, really worked hard last season. His workout buddy was Jason Vargas, who's actually another candidate for comeback player of the year. And they worked hard through 2016, and he hit the ground running in 2017, and just never looked back. And obviously set the Royals franchise record for home runs with 38, and beating Steve Alboni's record, which had stood since 1985. And just a tremendous honor for him. And we should probably point out too that another former Royal, Greg Holland, won on the other side in the National League. So he had some tremendous years here and helped them to the World Series in 14 and helped them get to the World Series in 15, and a great honor for him as well.
Absolutely. Comeback Player of the Year, an important award. And yeah, it says a lot about Moustakas to come back at such a high level, really better than he ever was. You wrote a piece about the Royals' new hitting coach. It's not the Hall of Fame quarterback, Steelers quarterback, as you pointed out, but his name is Terry Bradshaw. And it's a cool story, though, with this Bradshaw. He kind of been through the organization, one of those guys that's worked his way up. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's been in the system since the 2000, and finished his career as a minor league deal with the Royals, and was a hitting coach at AA, hitting coach at AAA. And I've spoken to a number of Royals hitters over the years who really give him credit for helping them get to the big leagues. Just a tremendous work ethic and a solid guy overall, and knows his stuff about hitting. And of course shares a famous last name, first name, last name with the NFL icon. And he's had some really funny stories about that over the years, where a UPS truck shows up at his house and, he's got tons of stuff that he's supposed to autograph, jerseys and footballs and photographs and stuff like that. And I asked him point blank, I said, do you ever wish you'd, been named something else, some other name? And he laughed. He said, no, this is kind of cool to have this kind of celebrity. And I think it's going to actually escalate a little bit now he's got a big league job. I know when he was hired for the Royals minor league coach, Twitter really, rose up and go, well, wait, Terry Bradshaw? They were a bit astounded too. And so he's going to have to put up with that a little bit longer, but he's good with it. He's come to peace with it and has some funny stories about it too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can identify a little bit with Darwin trying to do takeout orders and everyone with the Charles Darwin joke. So I can identify with that once in a while. Let's look at some of the players that the Royals have arbitration eligible, non-tender candidates. Four guys from what I counted there: Kelvin Herrera, Nate Karns, Brandon Maurer, Mike Morin. Any surprises you expect? The deadline is tonight, so by the time people listen, we'll know what the situation is. But any surprises that you expect?
Yeah, I'm going to play it safe here and say I don't think so. But you just never know. I mean, more likely they go to arbitration with at least three of them. I'm not quite sure about Mike Morin. You know, it would not be a ton of savings for them, because even if he goes to arbitration, he's only probably going to get about $700,000. And he was a guy who just came up, they claimed, in mid-September, and only got in about five or six games for them. So with Herrera, he is slated to make over $8 million if he gets to arbitration. And more likely they go that route, or they sign him to a one-year deal, maybe as soon as today, who knows. And you know, he certainly would be a trade candidate as we approach the winter meetings in about 10 days. Nate Karns is a guy who's coming off thoracic outlet syndrome surgery. Certainly they'll tender him because he's going to be, if he's healthy, he'll be a definite rotation candidate. And Brandon Bauer, guy they got from the Padres in a big deal at the trade deadline last year, is also going to, you know, make a significant amount, over $3 million, I think, in arbitration. And but he's a guy with an electric arm. It just wouldn't make much sense to non-tender him. I think they, as they go to this slight rebuild, possibly going into 2018, he could be a candidate to be a closer. You know, that's going to sound a little absurd with how poorly he pitched with the Royals in the last 2 months, but he's got that kind of stuff. He's got a dynamic fastball, 95, 98 miles an hour, a very good slider. They just kind of, you know, got him, unlock the key and unlock his potential. And, you know, I think he's part of their future in that bullpen. So I would expect them to tender him as well.
We're talking with MLB.com's Jeffrey Flanagan, and we're about 2 weeks from the winter meetings right now, and just looking at the Royals, we'll take a step back and look big picture for a minute. They're now going into year three, removed from their back-to-back World Series appearances. They won it all, of course, in 2015. In the last 2 years, pretty much right around 500. They were 500 in 2015, and then in 2016, this past season, just two games under. So where is the team going from here? If fans are listening and they say, okay, is it a foundation we're building up, or are we kind of tearing things down and looking at younger players? What's the direction you sense overall from the team moving forward?
Yeah, it's really unknown at this point. A lot of it depends on what the market will bear. They've got nine free agents out there in the market right now, and the two names that you hear the most about, Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas, I think they will put all their energy into trying to bring back Eric Hosmer. Not saying it will happen, but they're going to put their energy toward that. Mainly because, you know, if they go through a rebuild, he's kind of the perfect guy to be around for the younger guys to look up to in the clubhouse. He's a tremendous teammate, tremendous leader, tremendous clubhouse guy. Not sure they'll be able to afford him. You've heard reports of anywhere from $180 to $200 million that he might get. But if the price, like it did with Alex Gordon 2 years ago, settles back down to the Royals, you know, they might have a chance to get him. Other than that, you know, Mike Minor, who was a guy they signed to a two-year deal from the Braves and really emerged as the team's closer in September last season and was fantastic. Unfortunately for the Royals, everybody else in baseball noticed that too. And I think he's going to get a multi-year deal, and he might be priced out of the Royals' range as well. So of all those free agents, I'm talking Lorenzo Cain, Alcides Escobar, Jason Vargas, go down the list. I just don't see them, if they don't get Hosmer, I really don't see them making a ton of effort to get anything more, and it'll be probably more of a medium to big rebuild as we go into 2018. They you know, made a run in 16, they made a run in 17, keeping the payroll up at franchise record levels, and quite frankly, they were counting on revenue from making the playoffs in those 2 years. It didn't happen, and now the bill's coming due. So I think they've got to cut back on payroll and, you know, kind of rebuild for 2018, 2019, 2020, and try to get back to where they were in 14.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, when you go through that rebuilding process, it can be tough for the fans, but also rewarding when you see new players coming up through the system. So as we wrap up, and a couple names for fans to be excited about kind of going into spring training that this that could jump off the page and say, okay, yeah, these guys are pretty much ready to roll at the major league level.
Yeah, I think they've seen a couple already. Whit Merrifield emerged as really one of the top second basemen in all of baseball last season. Jorge Bonifacio in right field was not even on the 25-man when they broke camp and came through with 17 homers. He'll have a full season in right field. Of course, we've always known about Raul Mondesi's potential, and most likely he takes over at shortstop for Elcides Escobar. And he's a guy that can be very dynamic, very electrifying. And the guy they traded for Wade at the last winter meetings, Jorge Soler, they've been waiting patiently for him to emerge as, you know, an impact bat in the lineup. And I suspect he's going to get that opportunity this year, most likely as a DH, just because of the way the team's positioned right now in the outfield. But they certainly need him to come through. And Chester Cuthbert, 2 years ago, had a real nice season filling in for Mike Moustakas when he was out. He'll probably step in third. Hunter Dozier is a guy. If they don't re-sign Hosmer, he could possibly be a first-base candidate. So Jacob Junis was another guy that was in the rotation last year. He'll probably get 40 starts this year. So there is some potential in the young guys, and I think you're right. It's going to be painful for a while for Royals fans, but I think they know the direction this club's going. I think they have faith in management and Dayton Moore, and they'll just have to get through it the next couple of years, and brighter days are ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we saw them rebuild and get to a great point, obviously, with those back-to-back World Series appearances. So the fans are in good hands with the management that's there now. Jeffrey Flanagan joining us. Jeffrey, thanks so much for the time.
All right, thanks, Darwin.
Absolutely. I'm Darwin Zook. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's November 28th, and we're talking some Twins baseball as we bring in Twins reporter for MLB.com, Rhett Bollinger. Rhett, thanks as always for taking the time. And right now, after Thanksgiving, kind of the calm before the storm in the offseason, the winter meeting's a couple weeks away, but Shohei Ohtani is on everyone's minds, and including Senior Vice President and GM of the Twins, Thad Levine. He said Sunday the team is making Ohtani a top priority. Is that a little bit of grandstanding, or is Minnesota really going after Ohtani as hard as anyone?
I think at this point they're definitely going to go after him as hard as anyone. I do think they have the bonus pool money. You know, I think they're the third most in the majors to offer him. They also just got some money freed up as well because one of their top shortstop prospects he failed his physical. So they're able to get some money back from that as well. I do think they're going to try their best to try to convince him to come to Minnesota. Will it actually happen? It's still very, very unlikely. You got to figure he's going to go to a bigger market. You know, I'm sure the Yankees and the Dodgers, those type of teams are going to go hard after him as well. But they're doing their due diligence. They've worked closely with his agency. They are coming up with a pitch. And, you know, I know that his agency kind of had a thing there where every team that was interested in him was required to send in, you know, kind of a pitch. And I think the Twins were certainly willing and able to do that. Thad Levine did say it's a priority for them, you know, to try to do what they can to try to get him. Because I think every team in baseball would love to have Ohtani, especially with the new, you know, with the rules here. You can get him for a real bargain here compared to what you get on the open market. So I do think the Twins are trying their best to try to sign him. Will it happen? It's very unlikely. But they are serious. It's just a matter of Ohtani's preferences.
Yeah, the cost you mentioned, I mean, that's certainly a point that I think appeals to a lot of GMs, is that you wouldn't have to pay a lot in that posting cost. Just wondering your take too, Rhett. Ever concern in a type of situation, I guess, because you're not investing as much money, say, as in the past with Daisuke Matsuzaka with the Red Sox, but still there's concern about a player adjusting, coming from Japan with high expectations, and this whole offseason seems to be about Stanton and Ohtani so far. Just wondering your thoughts overall with a player coming over. Dice K had an up-and-down career with the Red Sox, but a concern for teams with a young player, 23 years old, and adjusting not only on the field but off the field with those high expectations.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be tough for Ohtani. Like you said, the expectations are going to be huge this year. You know, he's definitely the kind of the most talked-about guy. I think the big thing with him, too, is just the fact that he's a two-way player. You know, he has you know, a fastball that can reach over 100 miles per hour to go along with a pretty impressive set of, you know, collection in terms of tools with his power, and he's got decent speed. He can hit for average in Japan. So really, Japan's best player both ways. He's the best hitter in Japan, and he's the best, you know, pitcher in Japan. So that's kind of the more interesting thing to me is what's he going to do in the major leagues? Is there going to be a team that's going to be willing to sign him to have him play both ways, or is he going to have to pick one or the other? And I'm curious to see what the Twins' plan, you know, kind of entails. Will the Twins be willing to let him, you know, pitch and then DH on days when he doesn't pitch? And the big thing, too, is that, you know, how do you stay healthy that way? We've never seen him ever do before. Can you pitch every 5 days and then DH and stay healthy and stay in your routine and throw bullpens, or are you more likely to be a reliever / you know, position player? So there's a lot of things at stake in terms of just how are they going to do this? Or is he just going to be a traditional pitcher or traditional hitter? There's just so many different options. I think that's going to be kind of the thing with him. I think whatever team has the best plan for him and the best fit for him is where he's going to end up. So, but yeah, the pressure is there, and the Twins have had some tough luck in the past with some players from Asia. It's hard to lump them all in together because it's all different circumstances and different situations. But Nishioka did not work out for the Twins, and we, you know, Byung-ho Park just went back to Korea as well, and he was the best hitter in Korea before he came over, and that didn't really work out. But same thing, totally different circumstance. Ohtani really is, you know, the top guy they've talked about for a long time now. He's very young, but you never know what you're going to get. And if it's anything more than anything, you're not really sure where he's going to play at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just read my mind right there, right, as I wanted to transition over to Byung-ho Park a little bit too. And I think that's, yeah, that's an example where it didn't work out as planned. He came over from South Korea and two-time MVP over there, as you just alluded to, and didn't quite meet the Twins' expectations. And now you just wrote about this in the last few days. It seems Park is going to be heading back to South Korea. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. It hasn't happened yet. Twins are still working that out because he's technically still owed, you know, $6.5 million over the next 2 years. There were some reports in Korea saying that he's going to walk away from that. That's not quite true yet. That's still kind of getting worked out. But the deal, at least according to Korea, is he'd go back to his former team, the Nexon Heroes, and play there for $1.4 million, which is less than he can get paid here. So I do think their systems have to work out some loopholes. But, yeah, as you said, it just didn't really go well. You know, he was two-time MVP there, hit 105 home runs combined over his last two seasons in Korea. Twins thought that power would translate. And the power was there to a certain degree. Even that first year, I think he hit 12 home runs. Including some, you know, really impressive home runs in terms of distance and trajectory, but it just wasn't consistent enough. And the, you know, I think the high velocity fastballs kind of ate him up a little bit, and the breaking balls as well. Never really put up too good of numbers in AAA, but also some bad luck. You know, he had a wrist injury that kind of sapped his power his first season there, and then last year I think just the whole, I think mentally it was tough for him, not making the team out of spring training, being taken off the roster. So a lot of things didn't go his way. I think could have went his way, but I think he'll go back there and do a good job because, like I said, he was the best hitter in Korea before he left. So, yeah, I think he'll be more comfortable back home. It's just too bad for his own sake that it didn't work. And for the Twins, of course, that it didn't work out there in the major leagues.
Absolutely. We're talking with Red Bollinger of MLB.com. And, Red, if Ohtani doesn't work out, or even if he does and he came to Minnesota, what else is Thad Levine looking at here as the winter meetings are a couple weeks away? We've seen Jake Arrieta's name, Alex Cobb, Lance Lynn, all linked to the Twins. They're all just rumors at this point, but it's kind of fun to speculate and see who could potentially be in the rotation for Minnesota next year. Would the price tag be too high on those guys I just mentioned, though? Would that be a problem?
I think those guys might be okay. I mean, maybe Arrieta might be too much. And then even, you know, Levine did talk about Darvish being a priority as well. You know, I know some people have talked about in the past, like kind of a Darvish, Ohtani, two-for-one package in a sense that could kind of entice Ohtani to come over. It would be having Darvish on the roster. But I think Darvish might be a little bit out of the Twins' price range and maybe Arrieta as well. But I do think that Lynn or Cobb would make a lot of sense. You know, guys that are coming off injuries, both of them have had Tommy John surgery, might lower their price tags a little bit. But they're both guys before the injuries that were very durable and added a lot of innings and a lot of value. So I do think both those guys would be right within their budget. They're going to go hard off their starting pitcher for sure. I think their priority right now is to sign a starting pitcher, or at least trade for one or sign for one as their first thing in free agency, or sorry, the first thing in the offseason. And from there, they'll kind of you know, add some pieces to the bullpen, potentially a right-handed bat. But I do think more than anything, getting a starting pitcher, and especially early in the offseason, is the goal in the front office right now.
Yeah, I'm sure they would love it if Johan Santana maybe could come back the way he used to pitch, as dominant as he was. And we'll just transition over to Santana for a second, as the Hall of Fame ballot is out and Santana is on it. He had several dominant seasons with the Twins, won the Cy Young twice with Minnesota. Is there a case to be made for Santana in the Hall of Fame, or was it just is it a case of longevity where he just wasn't dominant for long enough?
it's probably a case of longevity. You know, at his peak, he was an incredible pitcher. You know, the two Cy Young Awards, maybe even had a case for a third one. In his little 4 to 5 year peak, there was really, you know, nobody better in the American League. He's, you know, one of the better, you know, peaks of anybody really in the history of baseball. I mean, he really was incredible with that changeup. But I think longevity hurts him overall. He pitched parts of 12 seasons. You know, when he went to the Mets, had those injury concerns late in his career and had the shoulder problems and some of the, I think, Achilles problem, and it cut his career short there. I know he tried to come back there with the Orioles, a couple other teams, just didn't work out. So, but incredible career. I'm hoping that he at least stays on the ballot and gets 5%, because I do think he at least has a case because of his peak. But I do think overall, in general, just not having the longevity, and because there's such a crowded Hall of Fame ballot, you can make a strong case probably for 14, 15 guys in that ballot that he might just kind of get pushed off of it in that sense. But at his peak, Twins fans know that there's really nobody better at that time, and he was certainly fun to watch. And it deserves some consideration, but I do think overall it's not enough time in the majors.
Yeah, one guy who seems like he should be a shoo-in, Jim Thome, who played with the Twins, played with a lot of teams, but with the Twins for a couple seasons. In 2011, hit his 600th career homer with Minnesota. In your mind, is he a first ballot Hall of Famer?
I would think so, but like I said, such a busy, you know, crowded box, it's just hard to know how it's going to go. But a guy to have 600 home runs and have as much power as he did, and to be as well-liked as he was, too. You know, he was a great leader, great teammate, great to the media. That always can help you, too, and kind of put you over the top sometimes. But you'd hope that 600 home runs would be enough of a reason to put him in the Hall of Fame. You know, he hit number 600 with the Twins in 2011, very memorably in Detroit. Hit two home runs that night to get to 600 and had his whole family there. And pretty amazing milestone to get to. So Twins fans remember him fondly. He was only there for a year and a half. It was part of you know, the last couple of the Twin teams that were good before their little lull. They hit there, you know, the playoff team in 2010 in his first year with Minnesota, and had a couple memorable home runs there as well. So he had a great career. I do think he'll get a lot more consideration than Santana, but it's hard to know exactly how it'll go in that first year.
Absolutely right. And before we let you go, just one more thing. In the offseason, so much we talk about trades and money and what free agents are making, but there's a lot of work going on in the community and charity work throughout the season, but particularly in the off season as well. You wrote a piece recently kind of detailing some of the work players have done, Joe Mauer, Kyle Gibson front and center throughout the year as well. Just wondering if you could quickly summarize some of the great work that Twins players and the organization is doing as a whole.
It really is impressive. The Twins are definitely a team that's committed to the community. The Twins Community Fund is the biggest arm of that fundraiser for the Twins. They do a ton of events throughout the year. Joe Mauer is a huge part of that, being a local guy with all of his, you know, community work he does, including with the Gillette Children's Hospital. He was named the Twins Roberto Clemente Man of the Year Award winner for the second straight year. But even the younger guys get into it too. Brian Dozier helped spark the, you know, some of the hurricane relief efforts both in Texas and Florida. You know, Kyle Gibson is big in Florida and in Minnesota with his charity work. And he's going to be honored at the Diamond Awards. Eduardo Escobar, too, for his work in Venezuela. And all the guys in Puerto Rico, from, you know, Jose Barrios, Steph Vargas, Teddy Rosario, did a lot of work with, you know, hurricane relief in Puerto Rico. There's just a lot of guys. Pretty much any guy on that team you can think of probably has a foundation. Glenn Perkins, I know he's a free agent now, but he's a Minnesotan. He did a ton locally as well. And even Paul Molitor is very, very involved. And the new front office, I think now they're just kind of getting into it more. You know, in their first season here, getting kind of entrenched in the community. So, and we'll have a ton more going. You know, the Twins have the Twins Fest coming up, and, you know, the Twins annual caravan throughout the upper Midwest. And you've got, you know, the Diamond Awards coming up, too. So it happens all off season. Even when the weather turns bad, there's still going to be a lot of charity work going on and players out there in the community. But especially in the summertime, once the players are out there in Minnesota, just a lot of events going on all the time, even during the season, to raise awareness and raise money. People in the community.
Absolutely right. Yeah, well said. And sometimes people forget about all that going on, so it's nice to have those articles like you wrote as well about that. Red, thanks as always very much for the time, and great stuff as always. We'll talk to you next week. That was Red Bollinger, and I'm Darwin Zook. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras.